Football Weekly.
Cheer up, Gordon Brown. The city's booming. Man City, that is, as they hit Portsmouth for six. Hey, six in the city. While Liverpool and Spurs discover there's no such thing these days as a home banker, despite the fact that the credit crunch is making thousands of new ones every week. There's the usual Football Weekly roundup coming up of those games, Chelsea, Man United, and much more from the Premier League. There's the news from abroad. Herr Honigstein on a Bayern collapse that's got nothing to do with the housing markets. Sid Lowe on a big night for Barca. And Susie on City Out with the biggest top v bottom clash since Pink got her kit off. All that plus posts and the word on the biggest refereeing blunder in years from our very own man on the spot in Football Weekly. Hello all, and welcome to another week and another Football Weekly. John Ashdown, good to have you on board.
Good to be here.
Excellent. Delighted to hear it. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
Hello to you, your continental smoothie. And full of, how can I describe you, Kevin? Your usual bonhomie and Scots charm.
I am quite rumpled rather than being a smoothie.
Are you? Why? Have you had a rough weekend?
No, it's my natural condition.
Oh, okay. and very agreeably so. And, of course, Raphael and Kevin were both at Stamford Bridge yesterday for the big game of the weekend, Chelsea-Man United. We might as well start with that, shall we? A 1-1 draw. A fair result, do you think, Kevin?
I do, and I think one that will satisfy Chelsea. There were so many things went wrong for them. I mean, Deco in particular, it's funny, he's basically only arrived at Chelsea, and yet he's now the key to the way they play. And the knock-on effect to someone like Mikel John Obi was very noticeable. He wasn't as poised as he had been without Deco nearby to take the ball from him.
What's the word on Carvalho's injury? Is that likely to be long-term?
Well, no, same ligament. That didn't sound at all good. Although I must say, Alex came on and I think did better than many of us thought he would do.
Interesting. United, two games so far against top four opposition, just 1 point. That's the kind of form that usually costs Liverpool their title chances. Do you think United... is this slow start going to be too much for them to catch up on? Raphael?
I think if they would have lost, it would have been disastrous for their start, because 9 points, even though they're playing Fulham at home, would have been probably too much. But I think also a draw is not too bad a result for them, even though I have to say, I agree with Ferguson, who really said, you know, the game was ours for the taking, we really should have won it. I think there was a period in the first half, certainly, where they looked very dangerous going forward, where Chelsea were really not... What, it's not working? Or?
No, it's working, yeah. I was just raising my hand. I'm just surprised because, you know, watching it my own ignorant way, I thought that Chelsea actually looked like the dominant team for most of the
match. They had a lot of possession after United scored, but that's because, as Ferguson pointed out, United really sat back far too much and invited them forward. Mm. But every time United hit them, I thought if they just played the counters with a bit more poise and guile, they would have been able to kill them off. So I think, in the end, I think Ferguson will feel slightly miffed that perhaps they let a chance go.
I think Ferguson's letting himself off there. I felt he was responsible for the counter-attacking thing, which could have worked, but I thought Chelsea were there for the taking, and the fact that United weren't going for them allowed Chelsea time to recover a bit, and they got stronger and stronger. Maybe they could have won the game.
How long do I have to wait? I know two games is too early before I say that Berbatov was an absolutely rubbish buy. He was absolutely dismal yesterday.
And who told you in last week's podcast?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. You did, Rafa.
You're so modest, Rafa. It's one of your many great qualities.
Well, one of the posters coming in because, some people were taking exception to that and they were saying, you know, he's not going to be the new Cantona, he could be the new Varon. And I think that might be flattering him on the basis of these two matches. I thought he was dismal.
I think Spurs fans also say he wasn't playing well at the tail end of last season, so it's been a long, quiet spell.
£30 million.
I mean, but he has great talent, to be honest.
Yeah. He is a great player,
but he's taking the place
of
another player that's got great talent. That's the thing. When I was watching the game, I thought, well, why wouldn't you have Tevez out there actually working hard, making stuff happen, instead of this guy wandering vaguely around the pitch? But hey, that's just me.
I think the best thing, though, was seeing Rooney mostly playing centrally. He's far, far better there. I mean, as long as that happens, I'm pleased, because I think it's been a kind of wasted talent recently, Rooney.
John Ashdown.
I just wonder, we get excited about these big Chelsea-Man United games, but I thought Solomon Kalou hit the nail on the head afterwards when he pointed out that Chelsea, the title started to slip through their fingers when they drew against Wigan. And do these sort of big matches between the big four actually really matter when it comes to, is it actually more important to go to Hull or Bolton and get three points rather than draw?
That's interesting, because people talk about Liverpool's chances, as I was referencing, a minute or two ago.
Yeah, it's getting 3 points, not just drawing, but beating the teams that are lower down the league, and more, perhaps more important.
There's one other thing totally unconnected I was thinking about. It's funny how Petr Cech, being a goalkeeping god, doesn't get reproached very much. I was watching on TV, it's a shocking mistake by him for the goal, and the pundits are all talking about the right back and what he did and so on. Cech could have saved it.
Yeah, indeed so. Van der Sar equally in all sorts of trouble. But he will be fit for next weekend as long as Rio Ferdinand allows him back on the pitch.
And again, Kuchak, why is he not near this edge of 6-yard box to collect the free kick from which Kalou scores?
Questions that demand answers. Answers that I can't give you, Kevin, sadly. United are the most undisciplined team in the Premier League this season, despite playing a game less than nearly every other team. 14 bookings they got, although half of them came in just that one game on Sunday. Arsenal, now top of the pile following their Beauty and the Beast clash with Bolton, 3-1 of the victory for Arsenal's young Gunners. We can skip past this one, can't we?
Very good. I mean, they showed a bit of depth, didn't they? Left out a couple of players, still caught well, came back from 1-0 down. Yeah, quite encouraging.
Although another shocking tackle on
oh, yeah.
Was it on Walcott, under Nielsen?
It was on Clichy.
Clichy, that's right.
Although for me, it wasn't a shocking tackle. I think it was a fine tackle, yeah.
Because it didn't actually break the leg. That's
no,
why.
He got the ball.
It doesn't matter if you get the ball if it's dangerous. Yeah.
I didn't think it was particularly dangerous.
I think he nearly broke his leg.
Yeah, I agree.
It was a derby touch.
You're lucky it was bruised and not broken.
What are the rules say now? If you go in with your studs showing and you get the ball first but then take a piece of the player off as well, what is it?
You're not allowed to use excessive force. Crossing. You can't step somebody in the back and take the ball off them at the same time. This is not a fair challenge. Right.
But it's always been the case.
Yeah, of course it has. Yeah, there's nothing new in it.
Mm.
It's just that after 20 years of neglect, the Premier League woke up to the fact that it's actually useful not to have your expensive players out with broken legs, and new issues have been, the referees have been instructed to actually make decent decisions for a change, and people take a while to get used to this in this country.
Mm. Well, let's race on because there's plenty to talk about. Villa are now up in fourth place after their victory in the sort of West Midlands. Is it West Midlands derby, would you call it, John?
I think so.
Yeah, all right. 2-1 was it over West Brom?
It was 2-1. Yeah.
There you go. Same 11 players starting every single match so far for Aston Villa, which probably has an impact on that. It's the anti-Rafa technique.
Yeah, I mean, I watched them tell. They looked very, very tired, Aston Villa.
Oh, really?
they played well for a while and then just collapsed, more or less. And Brad Friedel, Philly Rockies, since he went to Villa, that wasn't a very good goal to concede.
Made a mess of it.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, Man City. They have now been taken over by our exciting friends in the United Arab Emirates. It is the United Arab Emirates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Abu Dhabi. I was getting confused on. Yeah, how
they're part of it, yes.
They're part of it, okay, good. 6-0, City's biggest ever win. Pompey's biggest ever loss. Where should we start? Joe's on fire, Robinho's on fire, Sean Wright-Phillips. They're all on fire. Did anyone see this game?
Sort of highlights. They also lost 4-0.
It was all highlights.
They also lost 4-0 at Chelsea. Which is
Portsmouth. Well, defending used to be their strong point.
It's very curious.
Well, it's the second week on the bounce, I think, that I saw Portsmouth play Middlesbrough last weekend, and they were 1-0 down at half-time, and Harry Redknapp started off with the 5-3-2 wing-back thing. And I think apparently he did the same on Saturday and got to half-time and just changed it and went back to 4-4-2.
Mm.
And you just think, you know, Harry, leave it. It's over. Forget about the wing-backs. Play 4-4-2 from the start.
Well, he's only a man in the air if he wants to play wing-backs.
No, that's the thing.
Well, apart from Klinsmann, of course.
What happened there?
That Germany update coming with a shock result for Bayern Munich. But, Man City, how far can they go? Is this one of those little flattering results? Or are they actual top four contenders?
When you see Chelsea brushing them aside, it stops you from getting too excited. But the thing was, they had some smashing players there before the takeover. I mean, I think they already were a strong squad.
Right.
I think also Ilano makes a huge difference. I mean, he's one of my favourite players. In the Premier League. And he didn't play against Chelsea, of course.
Right.
He didn't start. So I really like him. I think if he can get the form back that he showed when he came last year around, he faded a little bit after the winter break. Perhaps he didn't quite adjust to the fact that there was no break over Christmas. I think they could definitely be a number five contender for that fifth spot, I'm sure.
Oh, interesting. Raphael's just had a sweet baby girl. So naturally, he came in today. We were showing us all pictures on his mobile phone of, touchingly, the offside decision in Liverpool Sloan. There's a man with his priorities in order. Tell us about it, Rafa.
Well, I was I had Sky Plus.
It's a lovely picture.
Thank you very much. I had Sky Plus match of the day two last night and watched it again and saw the BBC had gone through all this trouble of digitalising the moment when Gerrard's goal was disallowed. And I hear Adrian Charles saying, well, you know, the referee saw something that no one else saw, clearly not offside. And I'm pausing this and I'm thinking, this isn't wrong. This is wrong. So either somebody, the guy who's writing Charles's lines doesn't know the rules, or maybe he's cross-eyed. So I I took the trouble of taking a picture on my mobile. And I will post this on my blog later on. By the letter of the law, it says that if you're ahead with any part of your body that you can legitimately score with, you are offside.
And you see that the body Torres you can score with?
Yes, legitimately score with.
Okay.
So you see that on this photo, you see that on this shot, you see that both Torres' right leg and his head is ahead of play.
Right.
And therefore,
this is on Gerrard.
Got it absolutely right.
Was it a free kick from Gerrard?
Yeah,
it was.
And basically, I don't know if it even touches Torres on the way in, but Torres is definitely influencing play because
he's going for the ball and it goes over his head.
There you go, Kevin. Are you convinced?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say because it depends on the moment the ball's taken and the moment the picture's taken. I'm not entirely convinced. No, I watched that on TV last night and I still wasn't convinced.
There you go. There you go. That's the whole problem with bringing technology.
It's too tight.
Referees could have one of those. They could just have a mobile with them.
I actually don't believe Linesman had thought that perfectly, you know.
Not a great week for Linesman, of course. We'll talk more about refereeing decisions a bit later on because there's been a doozy this week, hasn't there, John Ash?
Absolutely, yeah. Cracker.
Spurs Wigan meanwhile 0-0. Spurs have only won one of their last, 12 Premier League games. And reports, coincidentally, that Wandy Ramos wants to pack up and go back home to sunny Sevilla or somewhere in Spain. Is there any credence in that?
Well, he denied it, obviously, as you'd expect. Yeah. He said, oh, no, it's having a great time, apart from results.
But this came from The Observer. Is there any kind of truth to this, do you think?
The fact he denied it means probably something to it.
Well, you can see why he'd feel less than...
Maybe he can't leave the house at the moment. That would make you feel uncomfortable, wouldn't it? You know,
It does feel like Spurs are listing a little bit at the moment. There's not a lot of forward momentum.
They are at the bottom.
I think though he's probably getting the least criticism. Most people think, well, this whole Berbatov thing dragged on so long it stopped him from making signings, and that's not Ramos's fault.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. The good news is they are on course to actually do better than Derby's tally last year. They're not going to break that record at this rate. We've got 2 points from five games, which I think works
They'll be mid-table in the end.
They will? Okay. All right. And fellow club in crisis, Newcastle. Who I think they're playing in the Carling Cup, aren't they? We were talking about
that. They are, yes.
Yeah, there you go. Newcastle, who lost, no great surprise there, 3-1 away to West Ham United. Great start for Gianfranco Zola. And not a bad home debut from David De Micheli, who I think many people, myself included, were less than convinced would be a success because he's come off a rubbish season. But they look good, but then they were playing Newcastle.
It's also the subplot of Michael Owen scoring again. You know, and this question of whether he'll go cheaply in January to one of the bigger clubs.
Do they want him?
Well, that's the whole point. If they allege that perhaps they do. You know, because he looks dangerous again.
You know? He does. Yeah. And is there any truth to this rumour, John Ashton, that you've been peddling around the internet, that Kenny Dalglish is once again on Newcastle's want list?
I think if you believe a certain tabloid, there is. Yeah, they want to turn the clock back. And
do you believe that tabloid?
Well, I believe all the tabloids. Surely they don't print lies, do they, James?
Right.
But it would seem surprising because I think the story was that Mike Ashley wants him back in as a temporary manager 8 years after sort of leaving the game, and obviously it worked so well with bringing Kevin Keegan back in that.
Well, in a way, maybe it did because they were off to a cracking start this year before he got the hump.
I guess. But I would be extremely surprised if that actually came to pass. I'm sure that he's a name that's been bandied around because they're struggling, aren't they? I think Terry Venables has apparently turned them down, or at least that he was linked and he's ruled himself out. So there's not a lot of managers sort of left on the list.
It's an interesting catch-22 situation because obviously a lot of people are scared off by the fact that they don't want to buy a club who hasn't got a manager. Managers don't want to come to a club who haven't got a real owner. So it's not good.
A mess. Very good. Well, that's a pretty comprehensive roundup of the Premier League. Nice one, guys. In a second or two, we'll have the pleasure, I hope, of speaking to Sid. and finding out all about what he got up to at the weekend, and begin our European roundup of thusly.
Football Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
All right, OK, Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, Sid. Where are you, Sid?
I'm in a taxi on my way to the airport in Asturias, having watched Sporting kick on against Barcelona last night. But I'm running a bit late because I forced the taxi driver to take a detour for the Sporting Gijón club shop to get a mug for that marvellous collection.
Oh, you have a mug collection?
Well, my father has a mug collection. I believe I've been mercilessly ribbed for this.
Of course. Yes, yes, yes. I always get distracted by the shirts on the wall, that business. Excellent. How did you enjoy your evening in Gijón?
Gijón, yeah.
Gijón.
Absolutely fabulous. Really brilliant, and it was just such a nice experience to be there. Sporting are a club that haven't been in the first division for 10 years, and really should be. I mean, they're a big club with a good fan base, and it was just really a really great experience last night. Fans really sang all the way through the game. There was a real atmosphere about it. There was a real sense of we're back, because of course it was Barcelona in town. A sense of not just Gijón, in fact, but the whole region kind of being returned to the front line of football. And it was just a really really great experience in terms of the atmosphere and so on. Unfortunately for Gijón, while their fans were absolutely brilliant off the pitch, their team was absolutely awful on it.
6-1, the score. You were threatening this last week, I think, Sid, when you were saying that you had the feeling that sooner or later it was all going to come together for Barca, and it really did now.
Yeah, I think I was 20 goals short, though. Didn't I say I thought Barcelona were going to beat someone 26 at some stage? I didn't expect them to concede, but this is now, and this is worrying for Barcelona, despite the 6 goals. Barcelona, in the last 3 games in the league, have managed to concede 3 shots on target, and all 3 of them have gone in, which is a weeny bit worrying for them. But they were absolutely phenomenal last night. They did all of the things that they do well, but they had the cutting edge and the finishing power to go with it. And I think to some extent, Sporting Gijón kind of played into their hands a little bit, in so much as teams have worked Barcelona out, most teams, and they come and they play very, very defensively, and they close it off and they try and frustrate Barcelona. Last night, Sporting went, you know what, let's go and attack them. And they got caught.
Well, that sees Barcelona move up a bit into the top half of the table, are they now, Barcelona?
Yeah, they're ninth today, which is obviously quite important, because when the game kicked off last night, obviously by virtue of the fact that it was the last game of the weekend's game, but, you know, the Sunday night match, Barca actually went into the game in the relegation zone in 18th. They're now ninth, which is a little bit better for them.
Brilliant. Meanwhile, Atletico... Oh, it's Valencia leading the way still, is that right?
It is Valencia on top with Almeria just behind them. Valencia won 1-0. David Villa, who wasn't actually supposed to be playing because he picked up an injury, did play and provided a really, really good assist for a guy called Juan Mata. So 2 Asturians coming together to score a goal. Valencia, I think, looked really solid. I mean, you just wonder with Valencia that institutionally they're always kind of, you know, one bad word away from a massive crisis. But in terms of the players they've got, and particularly the coach they've got this year, I still think there is something to be said for saying that they're an outside bet for the title.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Also among the top teams there, obviously you've got Atletico Madrid, who are doing really well. They had their third straight 4-0 at home. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? 3-4-0s in a row. And they look really, really good going forward. They've sorted certain things out. I mean, one of them is the fact that they're more determined to be attacking now. I mean, they had good forwards already last year. They were missing Diego Forlán this weekend, and there was a sense that might cause some problems, but Florentino Arfongol came in and played really, really well. I think he's going to be quite important this year, enabling them to rotate a little bit up front. And they do look like a good side. I still think they lack a little bit of control in the middle of the pitch, but they're certainly worth watching.
Sid, they're a bit terrifying as the fourth team in a Champions League group, aren't they?
Yeah, Atletico Madrid have sort of looked at the group at the start, and of course it was all about Liverpool because of the chance to play against Fernando Torres, and also Liverpool was seen as being the strongest team in the group. But I think they went into it with a sense, well, it's fine, we can come second. But now, after that first game, they really are confident. They think they can get through the group, but not just get through it, but win it. And I think they may well be right. Certainly Liverpool won't find it easy to win at the Calderon. Mind you, Rafa Benitez might not even try and win at the Calderon. And I think there's a sense now at Atletico Madrid that they have the players to do something big. Again, as we've already said before, a lot of this is players being fit. And particularly at the back, it's very, very important that the two new signings, Ufolusi and Heitinger, remain fit. And Ufolusi in particular has made a real difference. You know, he's a guy that really, I think, scares strikers just by looking at
him. Well, listen, Sid, thank you very much indeed for that. We look forward to hearing more from you soon. And happy trails in the mountains and safe journey home.
I shall try. There is one story I should probably tell you about, though, James.
Fire away, Sydney.
I don't know if you heard about this particular story on Saturday at Real Madrid's training ground. It's a quite brilliant story. Guti has a stalker. Now, unlike most people who have stalkers, which are 14-year-old teenage girls that don't worry you in the slightest, Guti Stalker is a professional boxer. perhaps a little bit more worrying. Now, it's a guy is a professional boxer who's deaf and dumb. He's only got 37% hearing. Now, he's been campaigning against the Spanish Boxing Federation for years because they wouldn't give him his full license, which, of course, he wanted because he wanted to be able to box. His unique way of protesting about this was to go to the Spanish Boxing Federation and smash the windows in. He then found in Guti a guy who would support him. Now, Guti, quite brilliant. I think this actually speaks very highly of Guti, a guy who, on occasion, I've been critical of, but I think every now and again shows real sparks of genius. Guti went into a press conference once with a T-shirt bearing this boxer's face, and a sign, and written above it, there's a sign, I think it said, a pugilist forced to suffer in silence, and Guti was backing this guy's case. Now, no one seems to be entirely clear what happened, and I must say, I've met this boxer, and he frightens me. No one seems to be entirely clear what happened, but basically, somewhere along the line, this boxer has decided that Guti isn't giving him quite as much like, so he's turned against Guti. So he turned up at Real Madrid's training ground at the weekend, and was tailing Guti on the way in. Guti put his foot down, went through the barrier, not through it in Dukes of Hazzard style, the barrier was actually up, thinking that the barrier would come down in time. This guy got close enough to him to get through the barrier as well. Guti starts to accelerate, a security guard skids across between the two cars to cut them off. The box plows into the security guard, they get out of the car, and as Mark had quite brilliantly put it, I thought their choice of language was superb. They said he got out of the car and there was a bit of an altercation. He said the security guards tried to detain him, but they reckoned without the fact that he was a guy of great corpulence and pugilistic knowledge. this here boxer laid out one of the security guards. Police turned up and some poor sod had to clean up all the blood. But Guti now has a restraining order on him and two bodyguards to keep him company.
Good Lord, Sid. Good Lord. Fantastic story. Thank you very much for that indeed. And we'll be speaking to you soon.
I hope so. Cheers.
Thanks, Sid.
I'm sure similar things have happened to you, James. You were a regular on
television. I don't chase players anymore, really. No, I mean, not since the last time.
We have to admit, this pit-hole programme in the shade, hasn't it? I mean, it's, it all seems
well,
so
empty. Rafa's got to follow that now with his Bundesliga.
Come on.
Round up.
I might as well go home.
What have you got?
A wrestler been following Luca Toni.
But I'm sure lots of people are following Luca Toni and the rest of the Bayern Munich team after their disastrous, shocking, scandalous performance at home to Werder Bremen. Tell us more.
Well, you could say that he was to blame.
Luca?
Luca, because he had a fantastic chance and really scuffed it in the most terrible way.
What was the score at the time?
0-0. It was after 7 minutes.
What was the final score?
It was 5-2 for Werder Bremen.
At home to Bayern. In Munich,
on the opening weekend of the Oktoberfest, where Bayern traditionally like to think that they're unbeatable, certainly at home. Not quite the case on Saturday. They were 5-0 down after 67 minutes. Bremen scored literally every time they attacked. Klinsmann changed the system around the halftime from 3-5-2 to 4-4-2. Didn't matter. Massimo Odo came on in the second half. Didn't make a difference either. And of course, this is not the sort of result. Any defeat is a disaster for Bayern, but this one in particular is almost historic in its proportions. I mean, you have to look at the mid-70s when Bayern were once beaten 7-0 at home by Schalke. This was a Bayern team who were clearly in demise. You know, Beckenbauer, Hoeneß and so on, they were all, they couldn't stand each other anymore. But, you know, this defeat comes right into the period where Klinsmann had been getting a lot of good press for setting up Bayern in a way that made him very difficult to beat. They got a decent win away to Steaua Bucharest in the Champions League, and people thought, aha, you know, the revolution is happening. And now, you know, one result won't put him into a serious crisis, but it, of course, asks some serious questions, not only about his management, but also about the team.
How many games have they had?
This was the fifth game.
And how many wins has he had?
He's drawn the first two, he's won two, and he's lost one.
No, it's not impressive, is it? Meanwhile, Hoffenheim are back up to second place. That team that's raced up from, what was it, 7 years ago they were in the third division, is it? I believe so.
No, two years ago they were in the third division.
They were in the third division, yes. 2 years ago.
Yes, they've had two straight promotions.
Right.
They were in the seventh division in 1990, I believe.
Wow.
So they've come a long way, and any other weekend, this would have been the result of the week, perhaps even of the season, because they beat a Dortmund side who were all full of confidence. They also have a new manager, Jurgen Klopp, one of these new guys who very well respected, a lot of euphoria when he came. But here are these young upstarts who play this really amazing, slick counter-attacking football. Everything is one touch, based on Arsenal, really, because Ralf Rangnick, the manager, went to Arsene Wenger as an intern, looked at all the setup and tried to implement as much of it, not just on the pitch, but also the whole academy structure. At Hoffenheim, where obviously they're bankrolled by the billions of a software magnate, and they're getting results, and they're in second in the league. And while I think it's a bit too early to factor them in for possible Champions League places, I think finish in the UEFA Cup places is not beyond them.
Excellent. Schalke, meanwhile, still top of the pile. Borussia Dortmund, I have to say, they look pretty shabby against Udinese in the UEFA Cup.
They were terrible. Well, I thought Udinese were very good. I don't know.
Without their first-choice striker.
Yeah, they left him on the bench, Di Natale and
Quagliarella.
Mm. But they look great, Udinese. I don't know if it was a reflection on them or whether Dortmund were so bad.
How's Martin Jol doing?
Martin Jol had a very difficult week. After a very good start, where Hamburg were top of the table last weekend, they've had a very unconvincing draw in the UEFA Cup, a 0-0 against a side I won't even try to pronounce. They're from Romania as well. And then a 3-0 defeat away to Wolfsburg on Sunday, which was a problem because Hamburg have been coming back from 2-0 down three times. This time they couldn't do it. And it sort of revealed the real fragility at the back of this Hamburg defence. I mean, as long as you can come back, you gloss over the fact that you're conceding a lot of goals, but this time they couldn't, even though they had chances. And, you know, people asking a few questions. Why is this Hamburg side, who were known for their defensive rigour, perhaps even to the point of exaggeration under Huub Stevens, who always loved the nil, to a side who's shipping goal left, right and centre. So, not a good week for him, I'm afraid.
Can I ask a trivial question? It was an offence against the universe when Wolfgang Wolf ceased to be a manager of Wolfsburg. Yeah. What's he doing nowadays? I mean, obviously he couldn't have another job. Where else would he be able to work?
He's had another job at Kaiserslautern. He didn't do well there. He's angling for a job, is the truth. But I don't think he'll get any get in at Wolfsburg anytime soon, because Felix Magath is doing a pretty good job.
It's only a club he can work, isn't it?
Same with Arsene Wenger, presumably going to
Wolverhampton Wanderers, maybe.
Yeah,
exactly. Sure, yes.
Or Roma.
I think they're doing okay, though, aren't they, Wolves?
Or Roma, he said, segueing neatly too, into the Italian. Susie Campanali.
Hello.
Hi, Susie. How are you?
I'm all right. Yourself?
Yeah, all well here. All well here. And we're all very excited to hear the latest from Serie A. There has been some suggestion that you talk about Milan too much, but I think it's going to be inescapable this week. Are they not the big story?
It is, because obviously they finally won a match.
God bless them. Tell us more, Susie.
Well, basically, they had their worst start in 22 years. They had crisis talks with Ancelotti, his head on the block. But he took decisive action against Lazio in dropping Ronaldinho and Shevchenko. Plus, of course, Pirlo was out injured for 2 months with a thigh strain. So actually, that could be a blessing in disguise, because it forced him to change the system. He put Gattuso in Pirlo's place, which is quite a change, I think anyone can agree. And we put Kaká behind Pato and Borriello, and they won 4-1.
Yeah, it was helped by the fact that Kaká had his best game in, well, I can remember, in ages. He was sort of man of the match, no?
Oh, he was wonderful. He scored a fantastic goal as well, but he was also combining well with the others. And he's clearly getting his fitness back. That's the important thing.
Do you think he also...
But Kaká said something very, very smart, actually, before the game. He said, the problem with Milan was, we thought we could just go out there, play and win on autopilot. We lost sight of our defects and consoled ourselves with our virtues.
Yeah. Sounds like a direct criticism of Ronaldinho to me.
He meant everybody.
Yeah.
And it's a criticism that can also be levelled at Roma, because they had exactly the same problem. Everyone thought it was fitness, because they were visibly second to the ball against anyone. But clearly it's not that. They were just not running properly. They were not organised. They just, everyone thought, put a load of star names out there and they'll do something.
Yeah. Well, Roma, of course, a city where, as many people have found, it's very, very easy for fans and players to lose the run of themselves. And I think after last season, it was always a little bit on the cards that those swelled heads might lose to a fall-off in performance. But they finally got a victory as well this weekend.
Real Madrid, yes. They beat Regina 3-0. Right. Panucci scored again, remarkably.
Yeah.
And Aquilani scored a cracker, and then Perotta making his comeback. Totti is still not exactly fit. He's still struggling with his knee injury, but he's on his way back. But it was at least it was a marked improvement, because after losing to Cluj midweek, it was just horribly embarrassing.
Indeed so. We should mention that Milan not just getting a win, but getting a 4-1 victory against a Lazio team that came into this as very much, you know, the top form side. They were top of the table, I think, even, weren't they?
They were top of the table with 6 points, 100% record. And Zarathia scored again, fourth goal now in three games. So he's had a fantastic start to the season in Serie A. But Lazio are no longer at the top. Now it's the usuals, Inter and Juventus.
Right. And it's Inter who Milan will be facing next week in the Milan derby.
Yep, Sunday night. That's going to be interesting.
Are Milan going to come back down to earth with a bump in that one?
Well, we'll see, because their styles are going to be very interesting to see them against each other, because Inter are now focusing a lot on the counter-attack. They have been lucky, it has to be said, because they've had three own goals this season in their favour. And another one against Torino, who they beat 3-1. But Ibrahimovic is doing really well, and he's combining excellently with Mancini and Adriano. And that's not to mention that we've got Quaresma to come in. So they've got absolutely incredible options up front.
That's the thing about Milan, is that they do shine against these teams like Lazio who play fancy football and stuff, but Jose Mourinho's more pragmatic approach, I reckon, could prove a problem for the Rossoneri.
Yeah, because Milan conceded a goal against Lazio on the counter-attack, because as much as they have wonderful attacking play, they have a very slow defence.
Brilliant.
They have Maldini in central defence, and he's 39.
Indeed. And Jose Mourinho still popular?
Oh, yes, he's making friends and influencing people all over. The argument, which you may remember, with the Catania general manager, in which he said he should be punched in the teeth, that's gotten worse. That has gotten really ugly now. Because what happened was, and because it's so childish, I shall run through it in the style of a teenage girl. Mourinho said, oh, La Monaco just wants publicity. He just wants to get his name in the papers. And La Monaco said, oh, that is so not true. You are disgusting. You have superiority and contempt. And you're a blabbermouth and everyone hates you. And if you left Italian football, nobody would miss you. And Mourinho said, well, you know, as if. And La Monaco went, well, that's it. I hate you. And everyone else went. And then La Monaco's been sent to this disciplinary commission for incitement to violence, for saying he should be punched in the teeth.
Yep,
and La Monaco said, well, you're one to talk because you're all saying all these things. And then Moratti said, well, he's being uncivilized. And then the Catania president went in and said, well, punish him as well. He's being mean. And that's about it, really.
Magnificent stuff. We should have more reports in the style of a teenage
all of
girl.
Them.
all of them. Yeah, it was a fair point. I have to say, La Monaco, the bloke who said that Mourinho should get smacked in the teeth, was then pulled up on this by the minister, the Home Minister, Roberto Maroni, of the Lega Nord.
Minister of the Interior.
Of the Interior, right. And La Monaco made a fair point. He said, hang on, you were the bloke who, with your Lega buddies, announced in the field of politics rather than sport, that Roma had better watch out, the thieves in Rome had better watch out in the government in Rome, because you had 30,000 rifles ready to move. And if that's not incitement to violence, what is? All very curious, but I'm afraid nothing.
I tell you, Mourinho should watch out, because Catania are the club who, if you recall, last year their coach kicked another coach up the backside.
Mm, indeed he did. Good shout.
So they don't just incite violence. They take it. They really take it far.
Susie, that's excellent. Many, many thanks for entertaining us with that. And stay in touch with the Ute Argot, please, for your next report. And we'll be speaking to you soon, I hope.
All right. Bye.
Thanks, Susie. Penny. Excellent. That's Europe sorted. I like that sorted business. Still to come, though, on Football Weekly. One or two posts. And a look at the Championship with John Ashdown, who's standing poised, primed, and all that kind of thing, to tell us all about the extraordinary events in Watford this weekend. Posts, everybody. Camran 10. James, how could you barely touch upon Juve's win against European Super Cup champions Zenit in the Champions League last week? Who better to score Juve's first goal back in the League of Mushrooms, which I now understand are terrific? Yeah. Okay. Then the legend that is Alessandro Del Piero, and a fantastic free kick at that. I mention this really. It's just an excuse to bring in the post from S2 Goon, who says, "By the way, did anyone see Richard Keys watching that on Sky and saying and asking if Del Piero had been studying Cristiano Ronaldo's free kicks because nobody had scored a free kick before Cristiano Ronaldo turned up?" S2 Goon, I didn't notice that at the time. I went back and YouTubed it and was left astonished, gobsmacked by. But then that is very much their agenda, isn't it? Yes. Nods all round. Not that you and I work for any kind of rival organisation, Raphael. No. Tush and pish. Fred T. Jane writes to tell us that South Louisiana is not ready for our podcast, which he was playing on his laptop in the teacher's lounge on Thursday in whichever institute he educates in. And within minutes, the seven other faculty members had evacuated the lounge. Sorry about that. Interista wants to bring up the subject of referees' bad decisions, and a good week to do so, Interista. And he's particularly interested what the pod reckon on this injured defender playing a striker onside ruling that UEFA is upholding, because, of course, we saw it in the Holland-Italy game, and we saw it, and it was the Lyon-Fiorentina game when Fiorentina were 2-0 up. One of their players got an elbow in the face, went down. He was actually on the field, but in UEFA regulations, it doesn't matter if he's off-field or on-field. The fact is, he's playing. All the other Fiorentina defenders didn't realise they pushed up, offside trap, two Lyon players were onside, but the referee gave the goal, which they then scored because, you know, the injured player had been playing them onside.
Can I say in UEFA's fair?
Yeah.
I mean, if people could say they claimed they fainted, couldn't they? They could do it.
Well, they could no, they absolutely could. You know, but yeah. No, it's a fair point. Yeah. Equally fair, though, is Interista's point, is that if an attacker has to be influencing play to be considered offside, why doesn't the same provision apply to defenders? Why? Drink Sodden Mancunian is very excited that Sean Ingle bigged up Dusty in Memphis and says, "P.S. Has anyone else noticed that Villa Support Group always has their comments read out on the pod?" It's true, that rule applies to comments about
James,
him.
James, can I mention Dusty in Memphis? I went to Shelby Lynn's concert at the Festival Hall the weekend, and her recent album has some interesting versions as a tribute to Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis.
That's interesting. What's the name of that artist again?
Shelby Lynn. It was her first concert in London for 7 years. Kind of modern country, oblique soul. Absolutely wonderful. And the Festival Hall, what acoustics. Incredible. Yeah, it's a marvellous place.
Kevin, this isn't the sort of silence of what are you talking about? It's the kind of silence I wish I was as cultured and sophisticated as you. You've done this before, coming in with culture.
I just like Shelby Lynch, she's great.
I have to put my hands up and say, no idea who you're talking about.
Well,
and every time this happens, people come on the post and go, "Kevin, you're wasted on these people."
That's why I plan it, of course. Yeah. I research for every programme and find a new name to throw in.
Shelby Lynn. There you go, listeners. John.
Yes.
I tell you what. Big story in the Championship. There have been lots of exciting things happening, but we have to really start with the mess. The utter foul-up at Watford Reading. Tell us.
Absolutely. Well, for anybody who hasn't seen it, 13 minutes into the game, Reading win a corner, which is taken by Stephen Hunt, left-footed in swinging, which hits John Eustace, the Watford midfielder, sort of around his thighs, and bounces towards the byline, about 3 feet, 2 yards. That's 1 yard, isn't it? 3 feet.
Mm.
Something between a yard and 2 yards wide of the goal. Noel Hunt, Stephen's brother, cuts it back from the byline, pops into the box.
Did it cross the byline?
We think so, yeah. There's not the same level of sort of camera coverage at Vicarage Road as there is at Premiership games. Although it's not entirely conclusive, but we have to assume that it did cross the byline.
So it should have been a goal kick at that point.
It should have been another corner.
Oh, another corner, sorry.
But as Noel Hunt cuts it back, the linesman put his flag up straight away, and there's a little scramble. I think it ends up with Andre Baiki heading the ball against the bar, somebody else blazing a shot over, and the referee indicates a goal kick, thinking having not spotted the linesman's flag up initially. So all the players jog back towards the halfway line, line up for the goal kick. Scott Loach, the Watford goalkeeper, starts placing the ball on the 6 yard line. And then at some point during this time, the assistant referee, Mr. Nigel Bannister, informs referee over the headset that he's not understood this signal that he's given, and actually he was signalling a goal, which leads to all manner of confusion. Watford players obviously up in arms about it, Reading players staying quiet. As you would. And yeah, that was it. 1-0 up, and it was 2 yards wide of the goal. Incredible.
Astonishing.
To me, it's...
Steve Coppell spoke to the linesman afterwards, didn't he? Or he said it was an optical illusion.
Yeah, I think A.D. Boothroyd said that the linesman said it was an optical illusion, which, it's hardly an excuse, is it? And the referee must have there was no point when it went anywhere near the goal
right.
at all, and the referee could have seen it. Every Reading player saw it, and I'm slightly sort of...
disappointed in Watford that they didn't say?
Well, I mean, Watford were saying, because they were touching to see the goal, but all it would have taken was a Reading player to say.
I felt a bit sorry for the referee. I mean, I know you say youngest ever Premier League player. It must be referee. It must be pretty good. And I suppose it's an inclination to accept your linesman's word. That's what he's there for, isn't it?
The, I mean, the referee does have the sort of final say with these things, doesn't he? And he
oh, he does, yeah.
You know, I think he would probably argue that he wasn't entirely sighted. Yeah. And the assistant referee's manager came out afterwards and said that it wasn't. It's not always entirely possible for the referee to know exactly when the linesman is indicating that the ball has crossed over the line, which seemed to be a slightly, you know, a bad excuse, because surely the linesman would tell him at which point he felt the ball had crossed the line. I'm surely the officials can see from a player reaction. I mean, there was no appeal. There was there was nothing at all. And then obviously lined up for this goal kick.
Councillor, thank you. You did a panel on the paper of weird goals in the past, including one of my favourites that I've forgotten about. I must mention this, Dundee United against Partick Thistle. Paddock on Dundee United, ball hits the crossbar, goes over the line. Partick player knows it's a goal, picks up the ball and kicks it out. And the referee waves play on. Not a penalty, not a goal. I remember that well, it was great.
Yeah, it is on YouTube, so you can see it.
Paddy Pizzle, Dundee United, 1993, Paddy Connolly.
Rafa, I see one of your German ones here, Bayern Munich against Nuremberg in 94.
Yes, yeah, it's also known as the Phantom Goal in the Bundesliga, a very famous incident, and very similar, because after a corner for Bayern, the very... very difficult situation with lots of bodies flying around in the five-metre area. And Thomas Helmer tries to score. The ball actually hits him at the back of his thigh and then goes out for a free kick. And somehow, the same situation, the linesman somehow saw or thought he had seen the ball cross the line. Now, at the time, this was the penultimate game of the season and Nuremberg were fighting against relegation and Bayern were fighting for the title. So there was such an uproar that the DFB, despite, of course, FIFA's wishes and everything that's in the rule books, decided they had to repeat this game because they could not let it stand. Of course, it was 2-1, so the goal was decisive as well. Mm. It didn't do Nuremberg any favours because they lost a repeat 5-0, and Bayern did go on to win the title that year. But you just wonder if that had been a later game, you know, and that those two teams are fighting for the championship or fighting against relegation, you know, would there have been a different reaction?
That's amazing that FIFA allowed the replayed game to stand. They were furious, weren't they, FIFA?
Yeah, I mean, the DFB got into a lot of hot water, but, you know, FIFA, what can they do at the end of the day? I mean, they can't tell them, no, that we don't count the game.
Just to save anyone spending 80p on The Guardian today, they really want to do more. There's a classic one from Clive Allen, which he thumped in so hard, it actually rebounded off the stanchion at the back of the goal and straight out before the linesman had even noticed, and play just continued.
Yeah. But isn't it amazing that you can actually retract a red card?
Yeah.
On the evidence of video, or retract the ban, we should say, not the red card, actually. But can't do the same thing when the bar clearly hasn't crossed the line.
Mm. Man it's United's insane. Classic one against Tottenham when Roy Carroll basically scoops it back out. Very good. Oh, now the Championship, we've probably run out of time, but, you know, Wolves are roaring away at the top, and they're playing Bristol City, who moved up to fifth next weekend. This fellow from Charlton, I'm going to struggle here, Iwilumo.
Chris Iwilumo, yes. Yeah.
He's been
Scottish.
Brilliantly for...
He is, yeah, he is Scottish.
Yeah, there you go.
Obviously he is.
It's about time he gets in the squad, actually.
Hasn't he been in the squad?
I think I don't think he's got a cap, but he's been in B squads and that sort of thing.
He scored 8 in 7 games, hasn't he, John?
Yeah, he's on
Am I right in saying that Wolves, two flying wingers, all guns blazing, exciting team these
it's
days?
It's brilliant, yeah. Before the season, a lot of the talk was of Birmingham having the biggest sort of attacking options and what have you. But it's actually, as it's turned out, Wolves have got more going forward. They've got Ebanks Blake, they've got Iwilumo. Kately on the right. Andy Keogh, who's a decent striker, and the younger Sam Vokes, who's
Welsh
striker.
Yeah.
So they've got loads of options. They've scored, let's have a look here, they've scored 21 goals in 7 games, averaging 3 a game, 19 points out of a possible 21. And they've beaten decent teams. They went to Charlton and won. They've won at Preston, who obviously were undefeated before the weekend. And they, you know, they've often flattered to deceive Wolves over the past few years. And the temptation is to suggest they've got all this attacking menace, and yet they'll struggle at the back. And Mick McCarthy actually on transfer deadline day did bring in a few defenders. Jason Shackle was one from Norwich, who's a decent young defender. And so I think they could well be the real deal this year.
Yeah.
Even though I'm still half expecting them to blow up at some point and wind up eighth. But I mean, at the moment you can't argue with the way they're playing.
Now, up at the top, behind them, you've got Birmingham, who you'd expect to be in the mix, as you say. Preston, QPR, of course, second richest in the world, are they, club?
I think they're the richest, aren't
they? Are they? What, even more than Man City?
No.
Oh, no. They've taken their title away.
But, I mean, certainly in the Championship, they're considerably, by some margin, the richest there. They're in fourth. You've got Bristol City, Reading, despite the... thanks partly to the events of this weekend. Cardiff, Coventry, Cheltenham, Blackpool. But down at the other end, some very big names in all sorts of trouble early on. Derby, who, of course, are only continuing their form from last season. Crystal Palace, though, Southampton, Nottingham Forest in the bottom three, along with Barnsley, who were such a force in the FA Cup last year.
Yeah, Barnsley were, I mean, sort of Barnsley, Southampton, you're expecting to struggle, really. Southampton have got financial problems off the field, obviously. Palace, I predicted they'd come second this season, but it's been a pretty tough start for Neil Warnock and his team down there.
Is that classic Palace, you know, form, though, that they start badly and then finish better?
Well, the last season they got promoted, they were down in the sort of the relegation dumps. And Ian Dowie took over and launched a remarkable sort of promotion campaign. And the thing is with the Championship, you can sort of see it happening again, because even though they're basically on the same points as the second bottom and the third bottom team, they're only two wins away from the playoffs.
Yeah.
And teams can go on. It's very different from the Premiership in that you can sort of see what, you know, Premiership teams, you can more or less predict results, and teams, you can sort of get a rough idea of the league table as you go through the season. But in the Championship, teams, almost all teams, are capable of winning sort of four, five, six games on the bounce.
Yeah.
And if they do it at the right time, then they could be in with the sort of the playoff shake at the end. I mean, Palace did it to some extent last season as well. They had a great end to the season. Sheffield United had a great end to the season last season, and they've sort of tailed off a bit this year so far.
John, did you expect Forest to do better? See their second bottoms. Early days, I know, but
I didn't, to be honest. I was sort of unconvinced by the defence before the start of the season, and it seems from sort of listening to what some Forest fans have been saying that the back four isn't quite good enough for the top half of the Championship. They have got, again, they're a team with great options going forward, Rob Earnshaw and what have you.
Well, fascinating stuff, John. Just to finish off, quick mention of the Carling Cup, the third round of which is taking place this week. I really can't get any enthusiasm up for this, although I am excited by the fact that Swansea City are playing Cardiff City, because Private Dick told me to be so last week in the post. Apparently it's one of the most heated rivalries in football anywhere, full stop. The first time that we've had the South Wales Derby since 2002, and anyway, that's happening on Tuesday elsewhere. Portsmouth taking on Chelsea, bet they're looking forward to that after the 4-0 thumping they got at Stamford Bridge in the league. Man United taking on Borough. Newcastle up against Tottenham Hotspur. Neither team can afford to snub the Carling Cup, of course. So that should be an interesting game. And, that's it. There's lots of other games, as I'm sure you're aware. But that is it for Football Weekly this week, until Thursday, of course. John Ashton, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Many, many thanks as well to Raphael Honigstein.
Thank you.
And to Kevin McCarrick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. And to producer Pete, who set up a Facebook page for us, if you're interested. If you've always fancied your chance to poke Barry Glendinning, I know I have, then you can get across to that. No idea. What's the address of that then? Let's just go looking for... Search for Football Weekly on Facebook, and there's going to be a link, apparently, on our Guardian page, which you can get in touch with us at, equally, if you're a bit more old school, at guardian.co.uk/football, and then just click on Football Weekly. Mind-bogglingly enough. Or you can always go to our fantasy football page and see how much better your team is doing than mine. All exciting things you can do on the internet this week. We'll be back, though, on Thursday, so speak to you then.